Let's see what the stew has for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by our awesome Patreon backers like the brilliant Benjamin D. Horning, the jolly Jeffrey Rees, and the majestic Matthew Arbo. Today, we have myself, Ange, along with Kira, Wen, and Senda, and we're going to talk about maintaining the tone of a game. Before we dive into that topic, though, let's ask our get-to-know-a-gnome question. What is one of your favorite genres of games to play, and is that different from what you like running? Kira, I'm going to start with you.
Oh my gosh. It's the same, actually. It's not different. I like a lot of different genres of game, I would say, except for maybe fantasy. Like, fantasy is the one genre I don't like, which is hilarious because D&D is like the biggest game and
it's so ubiquitous.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't really enjoy playing or running fantasy games too much. I do like Tolkien a lot, so that's kind of a clash for me in genre. Mm-hmm. But the games I do enjoy running and playing are usually, you know, indie or story games that are more story focused, that have a lot of character development. So they're kind of like, they can be any genre within that scope. Like, it could be horror or sci-fi or real life settings, as long as it has kind of that feel.
Gotcha. How about you? You win.
Oh gosh, this is a tough one for me. I kind of love playing like Law and Order style games, so police and military games. For me, the interesting thing there is to explore whether the character finds the system to be like good and right, and then coming to a decision point as to whether they choose to uphold the status quo. So that's something I've explored a lot as a player. I also enjoy running games like that, but I, I'll play whatever genre is. It's really, for me, more about the group that I'm playing with than anything else.
Yeah. How about you, Senda?
It's a hard question for everyone all around, I think. So I will say I tend to run games that fall into two very specific kind of genre buckets, and they are kind of real life emotional drama slash like things that are built to create empathy, and then things that are like super light and fluffy and tend to fall into a lot of like girl coming of age tropes. So magical girls and like the labyrinth heroine kind of stuff is what I tend to run a lot of, like those kind of two ends of the spectrum. But I really will play just about anything, as long as the actual gaming style suits my fancy, like as long as we kind of are story forward and I'm not going to drown in a bunch of mechanics and we're not going to sit here and rules lawyer everything, I'm pretty much game to play stuff, even if I'm not familiar with the genre or the tropes or anything. Like, I'll do it. I will love it and it'll be gotcha. Great.
And how about you, Ange?
I find I tend to run the games that I would want to play. And I honestly think that's part of how and why I started GMing, because I was getting frustrated at not getting the game I wanted. So I started being like, well, if I don't put up or shut up and actually try and run this. So like, I love superhero games. I run superhero games.
Really well. Really, really well.
I like those, the kids on bikes coming of age type of games, you know, and I kind of throw masks into that pile too, which is also the superhero thing. So it's like, it's the, you know, I can't think of a genre that I really like that I won't run. I can think of game systems that I'll play, but I won't run, but not necessarily genres.
Cool.
So let's get into our main topic. Kira's recent successful Kickstarter, Something Is Wrong Here, is a game that has a very specific tone intended for play. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Kira, you were going for that quirky, creepy feel you get when watching episodes of Twin Peaks and other David Lynch properties and that type of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very emotional-focused game on purpose. So, yeah, it's very specific. It's supposed to evoke, you know, emotions and the uncanny horror feeling of like Twin Peaks and Mulholland Drive. It's specifically attuned to those settings and feelings.
And any GM who's run a game going for a specific tone, especially a serious tone, can tell you how hard it is to keep and maintain that tone. So I thought it would be good to bring some folks together and talk about some tips and tricks for getting and maintaining the right tone for the game. Because, you know, it's really, if you have a specific tone, and this is why I brought Senda in, because Love and Justice has a very specific tone. You know, it's you wanna be able to get there and keep your players there as you're going. So Kira, why don't you tell us what you did with Something Is Wrong Here to try and help folks playing that game get to that tone you intended for the game?
Oh yeah, sure. So I did a lot of research because I think that especially with horror games in particular, it's like hard to often get the feel of like being scared when you're playing them. Like sometimes it gets a little silly because you're like, ew, that's gross, ha ha ha. Or it's just kind of, you know, it's like people can't kind of understand what type of horror you're going for. So someone over here is doing like Alien and someone over here is doing like Human Centipede. And, you know, it's just like you kind of have to figure out a way to calibrate everyone's sense of what specifically you're going into and how to basically consensually agree that the group of you is going to pretend to be scared for the next 4 hours or however long it is. And, you know, with horror movies, you can do that pretty easily, you know, if you're all just paying attention and quiet. But, like, if you're in a game, like, how do you all act kind of the same way? And so, like, I looked into, like, different LARPs and immersive experiences that encourage that kind of scary, uncanny, like, creeping you out feel and, like, what techniques they used. And some tabletop games, too. And one of the big ones was atmosphere. So, like, basically creating the room atmosphere to kind of encourage the game atmosphere. And so, like, it helps to, like, turn down the lights because it's a little darker, you know, and it makes it moodier. And literally asking everyone at the table, hey, can we agree to kind of be scared for the next 4 hours and try and stay in character, not talk too much out of character, be silly, try to maintain the tone together as, like, a group and make that a goal of the game. Like, actually asking people that at the beginning of the game is a super useful tool as well. So those are the two big things I think I used as tone setters in Something Is Wrong Here in particular.
Wen, with Wrath and Glory, have you found that you have any particular, you know, tricks you use to get people in that mindset? Because that also has a very specific tone.
It does, because in the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war. So, yeah, it's, again, what Kira was saying about the table contract in advance of the game and letting people know, hey, this is the tagline. If you never played a Warhammer 40,000 game before, talking about ultraviolence and that sort of thing. Because, again, people need to buy into the type of grim darkness that you want. We had a GM story night that we did here in Denver, where one of the GMs brought up, well, I told my players I wanted to play a dark game, and he thought that everyone knew what that meant to him. But you have to kind of calibrate in, again, to say, okay, what is included in that, and what is potentially excluded in that? So a lot of it is kind of a quick rundown for me of what the setting's going to be about, and like Kira was saying, getting the players to buy into that and to agree to that, you know, and then offering also the safety tools in that if the tone goes too far, everybody has a way to opt out or tone it back or, you know, let us stop and rewind for a second.
I do think that the setting expectations right at the beginning is paramount. One of the things like a lot of the games I end up running, like some of the Powered by the Apocalypse games, like Masks, Monster of the Week, Uncharted Worlds, or Tales from the Loop, they have their principles. They have these core concepts that are part of the game. And I always try and make sure at the very beginning to remind people, this is what this game is about. This is what you need to keep in mind as we're going. Because it's very easy to, you know, because we we all play so many different games that you start mingling different concepts and ideas and sometimes forget, no, I'm not in that space, I'm in this space.
Yeah, that was a problem that I had. This was at a game event, like a little mini con out here in Denver a couple of years ago. You know, I love Warhammer 40,000. We got to the table, it's 8 a.m., you know, I barely had any coffee, and we're playing Mouse Guard. And it turned into Mouse Imperial Guard right away because that was the trope I fell into. And, you know, that was a thing you can do, but it probably was not exactly what the GM was hoping for out of that game.
That's kind of hilarious. Yeah. I'm just picturing now little mice in the giant suit.
Yeah, the power armor. Yeah.
Stuff like that. Yeah. Senda, what about you? Talk to us about what, you know, some of the tools you use to get people into the right headspace for like love and justice.
Right. So it's really funny because we're talking love and justice, but I'm going to end up talking about Turning Point 2, even though it doesn't exist yet officially to anyone else's eyes. So the first thing, the thing with Love and Justice is a very, very short game, right? Because it's a hack of a 2-page game that, because we put a bunch of art on it, is 3 pages. And so there's very little space in there to do anything like discuss it. And also, because the tone is significantly lighter, people tend to fall into that a lot more easily. So it doesn't mean that they always do naturally. It doesn't mean that there isn't a conversation to have about it. But I honestly actually think that one of the things about that game in particular is that when you put it in front of people, it's so light and fluffy. Like, everything about it screams magical girls so much that I actually think that in a lot of ways, the art and the layout of the game itself convey a lot of the tone of the game. And mm-hmm. because it's a really short game that I actually put in front of people at the table because they need to make their characters real fast and, like, you know, they're picking from lists. So that helps too, right? Because it's narrowing the options to things that fit in genre. But, like, between those two things, the visuals, which give you a lot of sense, and then sort of the giving people a list of in-genre trope type stuff to pick and choose from and create their own character from, I think is actually really effective for that particular game at basically creating the session zero conversation that we didn't actually have verbally. Sometimes I still talk people through it, right? I always ask people, like, do you know magical girls? Right? And I'll talk about it.
I think one of the other things you do and other people who I've seen run Love and Justice do is the props. The little tiaras, the little magical wands, those actually...
like this one? Anyway,
like, visual like the guides. Tiara she just pulled out. but like having those at the table also like immediately sets the tone.
It really does. Yeah.
I have friends who run an anime-based game, Agonepsef. It's advanced... I'm going to get this all wrong. Advanced Dimensional Green Ninja Fortress 55. I got it completely wrong, but it's the elementary school at the edge of the universe, and it involves every single anime trope you could possibly want to throw in there. And they, when they run it at Origins or Gen Con or any of the big cons, they bring all the props. Every character has its own props, and they immediately, like, people grab onto those things and immediately get into the zone for that type of thing. So it's like, I think props are also a way to get that feel.
Yeah, it's pretty effective. And again, because it tends to be really light and fluffy, it doesn't mean that I'm not using safety tools and stuff, but it does mean that it's a lot easier to give people like a 2-line description about what the feel is that we're going for. And if folks don't know like magical girls, that's fine. I'm like, okay, so like think Power Rangers. Like everybody knows something that kind of plays like this,
mm-hmm.
even if we're going to warp it a little bit more towards like you have an adorable school uniform, obviously. And there's going to be cherry blossoms blowing in the wind as your tears sparkle by, you know? I mean, it's, you know, but people catch on pretty quick with the tiaras and stuff.
What do you folks do when, you know, you've done your due diligence at the beginning of the game? And you've gotten into it and you have a player who keeps, you know, like veering off and isn't quite there in tone. Kira, do you have any tools for trying to bring those players back or at least mitigate their, you know, what they're bringing to the table that might be muting the tone for the rest of the table?
Yeah, totally. I mean, as a GM or facilitator or some kind of authority figure, people will often like subconsciously look to you to guide the social contract, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So if you are in that type of role in a game like this, I think it's just like, hey, remember we said no talking, or no talking out of character, or that's a little silly, actually. Maybe we could do it this way instead. I think just like people sometimes need friendly reminders. And, you know, I don't know, when I've done that as a facilitator before, people are like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, and they just kind of like go along with it. But if it's kind of like everybody at the table, then that job can be easily dispersed among other people. So not one person is having to remind everyone all the time, which is kind of nice.
How about you, Wen?
Yeah, I would say for me, that's when I want to pass the reins to them and get them to buy back in by creating part of the story. And it works also if people seem less engaged. And I think for me, like, a lot of role playing and feeling my character, you know, happens in my head and maybe it doesn't hit the table. So providing people that opportunity to bring that to the table and create it as part of canon, I think is really powerful. So one of my favorite convention games of 40K Wrath and Glory that I ran this summer, you know, I just had like psychic energy wave run down the hallway, and based on how people saved versus that, their character was more or less aware of that this was real or not, but they all told us their worst nightmare. And like the guy who was playing the Space Marine, and you think 9-foot Adonis has no fear, like he saw the Imperium torn to shreds and his chapter, you know, destroyed, and there was nothing he could do, but he was still alive. And so he had failed in that way. And it was just like, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. That was so worth it. Wasn't expecting that at all. And like, you get the people to re-buy back into the tone by letting them create the tone.
I like that. How about you, Senda?
It kind of depends on what genre you're going for, because I do think that there are tones that this works better for than other tones, right? So for Love and Justice, which is something that's pretty light, the veer that people usually will get is they'll start trying to bring in something really dark, because there are some like dark, weird warps of magical girl shows running around and stuff. The system was just not built to do that. It's not really the tone that I go for when I run it, but people will see it and they'll have lots of magical girl experience and they may try to go down that path. And so usually that becomes a conversation with me when an idea comes up at the table, because I am very much a reactive GM in that I expect my players to be constantly feeding me story parts, right, to push everything along. And if something comes at me that does not fit with that tone, I will basically kind of negotiate with them to still accomplish that thing, but to do it within our sort of tone framework that we're going for. Mm-hmm. So it's like, can we do that thing, but let's maybe reel it back just a little bit so that it's not as dark, but we still accomplish like the emotional impact or whatever it is. Like, so it's something that I will actually negotiate with a player to basically adjust, like still do their idea, but like do it within the boundaries that we kind of, you know, worked on for this game for tone. Now, having said that, I think it's much more difficult to do that in a more serious game, right? Mm-hmm. So like, I don't know if I can do that in Turning Point. And also Turning Point is not a game that has a specific GM, right? It's a shared table experience. So I think that in those situations, it's much more important that like as a table, we've had the discussion and the agreement, and that we're all on board to turning to that person and saying, that's a little too far, or I'm not comfortable with that, or that doesn't fit the tone that we were talking about at the beginning. Like, can we negotiate as a table and kind of bring that back in to where we were, right?
It sounds like some, especially for the more serious games, it's like having some of the safety tools at the table, like the X card and stuff, can also help, because you can be like, you know, even if it's not necessarily something that's, you know, it's you can use that to help guide people back into the correct tone by being like, let's X card that and like fix it to go back into the tone we're trying to go for.
Well, I think the reason that safety tools also keep coming up when we talk about serious games and tone is because in a lot of ways, when we get to really intense gaming or really dramatic gaming, really emotional gaming, part of what we've discussed when we've discussed the tone and agreed on that tone together is that may also be part of kind of our lines and veils and the boundaries and our expectations for this game. So when people push around that or push past that, it can become an issue of safety really quickly, because it's not part of the expectation that we created for that game.
Right.
And it has the potential to go a lot further than someone, you know, is comfortable with or safe with, right? So I think that's part of the reason those keep coming up, and they are good tools for that. I got to play like a 5-minute preview of Alex Roberts for the Queen, which was fantastic. It was a little card game.
I love that.
Right? And but one of the things that she has going on in that game is that she uses the X card very specifically as a tonal control, right? Not just in a safety way, or it is still in a safety way. That's the thing. That's the point where kind of these things that we're talking about sort of meld together, right? Because it's also a tonal control that anybody can just be like, eh, not feeling that right now or whatever, you know, and it doesn't have to be a I'm triggered thing. But it's also a way for the table to just be like, that doesn't fit for me. Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, that was just a cool thing. That was my impression of it. I only got to play like 2 cards.
Yeah, no, I got to play that at Origins. I was there and had done, what's the name of the one where you're playing 2 characters in love that shouldn't be?
Star-crossed.
I got to play Star-crossed. But because it was a 4-hour session and Star-crossed really only took about 2 hours, Alex offered to bring out For the Queen and we got to play it. And my friend Chris is still like, It's months later, and he's still over the moon for that game. And, like, the moment Alex does anything official with printing that, I need to get him a copy of it.
I'm really excited about it.
It's really good. If you get a chance to play it or see it, do it.
I did the double feature at Origins with Sean Knitter, too. It was great, yeah.
Man, how did I miss out on all this stuff at Origins? Okay.
I've found that sometimes it can interrupt the flow of the game, but I have definitely stopped games, kind of treated it as a bit of a break to talk to players about the tone. I specifically had a Tales from the Loop game where a player, like, decided that telling his mom would solve the problem. And the other players were kind of willing to go along with that, and I'm like, that won't solve the problem, and NPCs will die. And I will have players crying at my table, and I don't want players crying at my table because these NPCs are dead. So I kind of had to stop the game and have a talk about what the tone of the game is supposed to be. I also had a Masks game where, you know, generally when I run Masks, I'm going for Young Justice. So there's humor, but there's still some serious... The emotions are real for what's happening, even if the action is over the top. And I had a player who was essentially playing Teen Titans Go. And it's like all of his actions were super cartoony, super over the top. And I kept trying to, in-game, guide him into the rest of the game with everyone else. And it just wasn't getting through. And so I finally had to, about halfway through, take a break and explain to him that he was being too cartoony, too over the top. And I needed him to rein it back in. And I felt really bad because I really upset him because he didn't realize he was breaking the game that badly. But the rest of the game actually went a lot smoother because he was more in line with the tone that the rest of the players were playing.
One of the interesting mechanics that I've been playing around with, and I wrote a little game for an anthology called Love and Resistance, and it's called Yes, and it's about people in a relationship who end up together, and the goal is that there are not a lot of LGBTQ love stories in popular media that have a hopeful and positive ending. They tend to be tragedies. So I wanted to specifically flip that script so we know at the end of the game, these people will end up committing to each other and having a relationship that works. And so the tone is hopeful, or at least as players on a meta level, we know it's going to go okay. But one of the mechanics I'm playing around with is that nobody keeps one character for the length of the game. And so you're really buying into the relationship and not the arc of a specific character. And so I think that's also one interesting way to kind of control the tone, is because the buy-in for the player is at a different level of the story. It's not, I want to see this character go through this experience and end up at point B. It's together, we're going to collaboratively all end up at point B, and I don't know how we're going to get there. And I think that's interesting.
That is interesting. We've been talking for a little while, so we should probably start wrapping up. Kira, Senda, Wen, any last thoughts on maintaining tone?
go forth and play games.
What else is there to find say? Find interesting ways to break the fourth wall for your players and get them in the headspace of their characters.
I like that.
Yeah. Communicate with each other. Use your words.
Say that to so many small children. Use your words.
We need reminders as adults as well.
Yeah, we do. Well, this show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can become a Patreon backer by following the Patreon link on the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. This ad is brought to you by the Tone Hammer. Modeled after the band hammer from forums of yore, the Tone Hammer can be used to gently nudge your players back into the right frame of mind for the game they forgot they were playing. If you're enjoying the Gnomecast, you'll probably like many of the other Misdirected Mark shows. Here's another one to check out.
Bone, Stone, and Obsidian. Wayne and Robert take monthly deep dives into Dark Sun setting and discuss it all across the editions of D&D.
You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com, at GnomeStew on Twitter, and GnomeStew on Facebook. Kira, where else can we find you on the internet?
Twitter is the best place, at Kira Nansi. It's KiraNansi.
Excellent. Senda!
You can find me mostly on Twitter. It's at IDELLAMITHLYNND. It's Idella Mifflin, but it might be easier to just find at Pandas Talk Games or at SAS Geek Podcast and follow a link from there. Because, you know, that's a thing. And also, of course, you can find my other podcast, She's a Super Geek, and Pandas Talking Games on the Misdirected Mark Network.
Wen, where else can we find you?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook and Twitter at Wendolyn Reichel. Just look at my spelling of my name on Gnome Stew. And hey, I just joined the board of Tabletop Gamers, GAYMERS. So find us there at tabletopgamers.org.
Excellent.
And Ange?
You could find me on Twitter at Orikez13. So, do you guys think we avoided the stew this week?
Yeah, it was a good conversation. We're safe. Also, I put in a ladder last time I was in there so that we could just climb back out.
Oh, excellent. Good thinking.
Gnomecast is hosted by Misdirected Mark Productions, the media arm of Encoded Designs.
Is because it is that. Wow.